just remind you of a couple of things. First of all, that podium that you're going to speak at is adjustable, and that means the microphone, you can move that around, put that at the right height, as well as the height of the podium itself, so that it's easy for us to hear you. So I encourage you to just take whatever time you need to make those adjustments. And I just want to remind you that we are, of course, recording the argument today, and we appreciate it if, for the record, you identify yourselves clearly, as well as the client that you represent before you begin your remarks. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Lockwood, Assistant State Public Defender, here on behalf of Appellant John Allen Davis. I do represent Mr. Davis in this appeal of the district court's denial of his pre-sentence plea withdrawal motion. There is only one issue before this court, and that is whether the district court erred when it denied Mr. Davis's pre-sentence plea withdrawal motion under the fair and just standard, with the reasons advanced by appellant being that he was suffering from the withdrawal from his gabapentin pain and anxiety medication at the time he entered the plea.
So it's your argument on appeal that the plea was valid.
That the plea was valid itself?
Yeah, you're no longer arguing that it was not intelligent and what have you.
The plea
was a manifest injustice. You're not arguing manifest injustice.
Manifest injustice was preserved below, and there may very well have been a manifest injustice. But because it was denied under the much more lenient fair and just standard as a pre-sentence plea withdrawal motion, that's the issue on appeal today. I'm not conceding that it was a valid plea, but because the court found the plea valid and then addressed the fair and just standard, which you do not have to have an invalid plea in order to have your plea withdrawn, that's the only issue before this court today.
My question really concerns a different question then as to what's our standard of review. That is to say, when the manifest injustice standard is involved, then ordinarily I think our standard is de novo. When we're talking fair and just standard, our ordinary standard of review is abuse of discretion. Do you agree with that?
Well, actually, Your Honor, according to the case law, I believe under both standards, when you look at the district court's findings under either manifest injustice, which we frequently see with a post-conviction petition, any post-sentencing plea withdrawal motion, or under the fair and just standard, there are normally two standards of review at play, because the validity of a plea, which is the fair and the manifest injustice standard, is reviewed de novo, but then we still are using the abuse of discretion standard to look at the district court's decision in that case. So when looking at the plea under the manifest injustice standard,
a district court has no discretion to accept a plea which is insufficient on a de novo review.
Absolutely, but you also have to look at the district court's findings of fact in reaching that conclusion, whether those findings are clearly erroneous. So it is an abuse of discretion standard that we frequently have to filter through with those manifest injustice plea withdrawal cases. We're very frequently before this court with post-conviction matters. The manifest injustice standard applies to plea withdrawal in those contexts, but of course, when looking at it through the lens of the denial of a post-conviction petition, it would be an abuse of discretion to deny the petition, but then looking at the validity of the plea is de novo. But today, again, we're dealing with a much more lenient fair and just standard.
So my question for you, and I have Dr. Cohen's full report and have reviewed the record, but part of the record is found at the district court's order on page 12, and in that, the court makes its own observations, which are, I think, findings of fact. He was alert, engaged, clear, and polite during the plea hearing. This court observed the defendant responding, interacting, and thinking in response to his attorney's questions. His body language was appropriate and in sync with his verbal exchange at all times. The court saw no visible sign of lethargy, confusion, or delayed responses on the part of the defendant. How do we review those findings of fact?
So those findings of fact would be reviewed for abuse of discretion, whether those findings of fact were clearly erroneous. But I would point this court to where those findings of fact are located. They're located under the court's analysis of whether it was a manifest injustice. Those are the court's findings of fact regarding whether or not appellant's plea was valid. The court found that appellant's plea was not invalid as unintelligent.
It was accurate. It's under the accuracy. Maybe that's what when you say valid.
Correct. The court addressed the three prongs of a valid plea under the manifest injustice standard before moving to the much more lenient fair and just. And yes, the court did make those findings of fact, but when looking at the fair and just standard, we're not looking at whether a plea is valid. There are only two things that apply to whether it would be fair and just. Under Raleigh, it is whether the defendant has advanced reasons to support plea withdrawal, and then whether the state has proven sufficient prejudice based on the state's reliance on the defendant's plea and actions taken. Now, I would assert to this court that we may be dealing with a few issues of first impression here today. The only case law that we have surrounding the burden of proof and the burden of production for what is a fair and just plea withdrawal basis is only those two prongs, that the defendant must provide, must advance reasons supporting the plea withdrawal, and that the state must, demonstrate why it would be prejudiced by the plea withdrawal, and that must be based on actions taken by the state in reliance on the plea, not just simply the passage of time, as Raleigh made very clear. Now, that's the only case law that we have, the only precedent to look to when looking at what is the burden under fair and just. Now, in Raleigh, I think it does provide a lot of guidance for this court. Although the defendant's motion under the fair and just standard was denied in Raleigh, the court in Raleigh did emphasize the fact that the defendant made arguments to support why he should withdraw his plea, but they were unsubstantiated. So Raleigh used the language, he failed to advance substantiated reasons why it would be fair and just. Now, in this case, Mr. Davis advanced a reason: I was suffering from gabapentin withdrawal. Now, if this was Raleigh, it would end there. That's all he would have presented, and that was not sufficient. But in this case, it went further. There's records that prove he was removed from that gabapentin medication just days before he was scheduled to start his jury trial. And then there is the report from an expert that demonstrates that withdrawal of gabapentin, such as Mr. Davis was undergoing, can affect cognitive abilities, and it could have affected his already diminished cognitive capacity and affected his plea. And again, they don't have to demonstrate whether that's valid. They just have to advance reasons that under Raleigh are substantiated. And we would, we assert that this was absolutely a substantiated reason. There was medical evidence to support it. There was expert testimony in the form of a report. And of course, there was the defendant raising that issue before the substantiation was provided.
So your argument is that Raleigh is more of a burden of production than one of persuasion.
Yes. And the only other language in Raleigh, other than they must be substantiated, is that the court must give due consideration to those reasons. And again, Raleigh does not define what due consideration is. So
I'm always supposed to do that.
So it may be an issue of first impression as to what does due consideration entail. Now, in this case, the court's order addressing the fair and just standard has one sentence regarding the defendant's plea, that he didn't address sufficient reasons to support that. And then it turns to the state's prejudice by the plea withdrawal, arguing that this was 20 months later and the state had released its witnesses from subpoenas and it would be prejudiced. And the court found that, yes, it would be. And I do present that as a clearly erroneous finding. And if you look to Raleigh, it's pretty clear that the passage of time is not enough. In Raleigh, the court went to that second prong to address the prejudice to the state, even though the court had concluded that the defendant had not presented sufficient reasons for fair and just. It did go to that second prong, and it did say that the state had not presented sufficient reasons, that the district court was incorrect in holding the state would be prejudiced because it was not the defendant's actions that caused that delay, and it was simply the delay in time. And in fact, in Raleigh, two witnesses had actually passed away, and they still said that wasn't sufficient prejudice. So again, in this case, the defendant did present reasons to support his plea withdrawal request that were substantiated. And the current case law, that is all that is required under the fair and just standard. It was undisputed in this case that the appellant did suffer from anxiety. He was given a Rule 20 evaluation to determine whether he was even competent to stand trial and to determine whether he was not criminally liable under McNaughton. Of course, he was found competent, but that just begins the record to demonstrate that he did have mental health issues. It was clarified several times during the course of these proceedings that he suffered from anxiety, and in fact, his version of the offense in the PSI discussed his extreme anxiety and how he was taking Xanax at the time of the alleged offense. And after he pled guilty, he again asserted his mental health issues to the PSI writer when he had his pre-sentence investigation and discussed the fact that he was suffering from extreme anxiety. He was reluctant at the time of the plea, and his biggest concern were safety concerns about the fact that his life may be endangered if he was in custody. Again, those all contributed to his anxiety. And then being taken off of that pain medication, which is uncontroverted, can cause, it can increase anxiety. It is also an anti-anxiety medication. And it can cause cognitive deficits from which Mr. Davis was already suffering at the time of the plea. And again, he didn't have to prove that his plea wasn't valid. All he had to prove was, at that time, would it have been fair and just based on the reasons that he advanced to the district court? And in considering that, again, the district court must turn to the state's burden as well. And the state didn't prove that it would be prejudiced to the amount that Raleigh requires, absolutely. And in fact, all the state argued was that during the hearing, on March 21st, 2018, the court asked if there was going to be any additional testimony from the state or from the defendant other than the report and the memorandums they'd submitted, and the state said no, that the defendant had the burden of proof and it was not met on any issue. Well, that was simply incorrect. There's two burdens that I would argue that the defendant has the burden to produce reasons, and of course the state has the burden to present reasons as to why they were prejudiced by the plea withdrawal based on their reliance on the plea and their actions taken in reliance on that plea. So if there are no further questions from the panel, I will request that you reverse the decision of the district court and remand for plea withdrawal for appellant.
Thank you, counsel. And of course, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. So counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Matthew Huff and I'm a certified student attorney with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I'm under the supervision of Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Linda Fryer, who is present for argument today and is seated at counsel table to my left. This court should affirm the district court, which properly exercised its discretion in determining that in this case, appellant had not carried his burden under the fair and just standard because he had not advanced substantiated reasons to show that plea withdrawal was warranted in this case. Appellant argues that he suffered from gabapentin withdrawal, which caused him diminished cognition and extreme anxiety, and this affected his decision to plead guilty in this case. However, this is not reflected in the record. First and foremost, most clearly at the plea hearing, appellant was asked both by his trial counsel and by the court about the fact that he had been taken off of his gabapentin medication and whether or not it affected his decision to plead guilty in this case. And at that plea hearing, appellant stated that it had not affected his decision. In addition, as the court pointed out during appellant's argument, the district court observed appellant at that plea hearing and observed that he was alert and that there was a lack of confusion with his responses. And so that demonstrates, in this case, that the plea withdrawal was not warranted. In addition, so following the plea hearing, but prior to sentencing, appellant moved to withdraw his plea. And so at that time, there was a psychologist who examined the appellant and created a report. And based on that exam, the psychologist stated that he had not examined the appellant prior to the plea hearing, and so he could not opine as to the appellant's state of mind at that time. And in addition, he stated that he was not qualified to make an opinion about the effects of going off of the gabapentin medication, given that he was not a medical doctor, and so he was unable to make that determination. However, the psychologist did state that the appellant could have been under the effects of gabapentin withdrawal at the time of his plea. However, the record does not show that. And so,
do you agree with Ms. Lockwood that Raleigh talks about a burden of production?
As far as on the state?
For, no, on the defendant.
On the defendant? I wouldn't agree with that. I think in Raleigh, the appellant had failed to show substantiated reasons, and so that was the issue. And additionally, one thing that I would note that Raleigh points or says is that if a defendant fails to advance reasons why plea withdrawal is fair and just to the district court, then the state doesn't need to show that it was prejudiced. And so in this case, the state did offer reasons why it would be prejudiced, and the court made findings that the state was prejudiced. However, because under Raleigh, if there's no substantiation for reasons of plea withdrawal, then the state in this case didn't even need to show why it would be prejudiced. However, the court still made those findings, and so I think that that's another reason why plea withdrawal is not warranted in this case.
How do you respond to appellant's argument that the state didn't make a sufficient showing of prejudice in this case? His reliance, or at least the district court's findings on that, are inadequate to support a finding of prejudice because it simply relies on passage of time.
Sure, and I think that so the court did note that there was a passage of time, so that 20 months had passed between 20 months had passed at the time of the plea withdrawal hearing. In addition, the court also found
it's measured from the date of the offense.
I believe so. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, a whole bunch of that time would have already gone by before the plea.
Sure. So in addition, the court also found that the state had relied upon the plea to release witnesses under subpoena, and also that the state had consulted with the victim's family about the plea. And so
Help me, counsel, draw that out for me. So what is the prejudicial impact of both of those things? I mean, I appreciate what it means to release the witnesses, but does that mean the witnesses are now unavailable? I didn't see that in the district court's analysis.
I don't think that they'd be unavailable, but it would mean that they would have to they'd have to subpoena them again and bring them in for a trial, which, and so.
But the Supreme Court in Raleigh was underwhelmed by arguments like that.
And that's true, Your Honor. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
So the Supreme Court says we believe the prejudice to the state was overstated by the prosecutor and the court.
And that may have been the case in Raleigh. I think in this case, too, so there were co-defendants involved, and so the district court was better able to understand kind of what it would mean by having to retry the case. Because I guess the district court would be able to understand just the complexity of the case. And so I think that in that way, this may be a different case than Raleigh as well. Does the court have any further questions? Okay, so in that case, we would ask that this court affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Ms. Lockwood, I had a question I meant to ask you in your first argument. You keep saying things like this: the facts of this case establish appellant's cognitive abilities are below average. And I'm not sure what you mean by cognitive abilities, because Dr. Cohen found that he had an IQ of 100, which I understand to be average.
That is correct.
And very functional.
Yes. If you look to page 10 of 13 in Dr. Cohen's report, it does say that results of testing indicate that the client has average skills in almost all intellectual domains. However, he does have significant deficits in several areas of cognition, most notably in organizational abilities. And these abilities influence memory skills. While there may not be a deficit of memory in self, this is amplified by situations in which information is not well organized and presented clearly. Of course, many defendants, when they're faced with a first-degree murder charge in the criminal justice system, can find that confusing. And in this case, despite the fact that he was a man of average intelligence, he did have those extreme cognitive deficits. And of course, they are supported by facts in the record indicating that he suffered a gunshot wound to the head at the age of 13. He was also involved in boxing as a young man, and of course had used chemicals throughout the course of his adult life, which did affect that. And then, of course, that was exacerbated by the gabapentin withdrawal. To turn back to the record, because I know, yes, there were questions regarding the district court's findings that the defendant standing before the judge seemed to be entering a knowing and intelligent plea. Well, you already know my position on the validity of the plea. It doesn't require an invalid plea for fair and just. But if you do look at the record of the plea hearing, it does not necessarily show that he was entering an intelligent decision here. I mean, the first question the court asked him after they told the judge he'd made the decision to plead guilty and they were going to go forward with a plea, they asked if he had any questions, and then he discussed the discussion of me leaving the state to do my incarceration. Immediately, he fixated on his anxiety for going back to custody and being attacked. Now, I think we should also take this into context of the time frame in the context of which this plea was made. Again, the defendant had been on this gabapentin for his anxiety and pain for 18 months. He had been preparing for a first-degree murder trial. Days before that trial, he was taken off the medication. Jury selection began. 2 days of voir dire, and then his lead attorney in his case had an emergency medical situation causing him to have to leave the case, and then there was discussions of a continuance. And then at that time, the same offer that he had rejected prior to trial while on the gabapentin, he decided to accept. And then his first question when being asked about that the next day was, I want to talk about where I can do my time. I'm afraid that I'm going to be assaulted, because in a prior murder case, he did testify against a gang member and was afraid for his safety for that reason. And again, in the context of being removed from his gabapentin and suffering from extreme anxiety, it does appear that would absolutely be a fair and just reason to support plea withdrawal. And then, of course, that reason was substantiated by that neuropsychological report by Dr. Cohen.
When the district court got the motion, it had the transcript from the guilty plea, Dr. Cohen's report, and it had its own recollections of what had happened at the plea. Was there a separate affidavit from from appellant saying, here's what I didn't understand, or here's what was going through my mind that day?
No. And let me clarify the record, because there were actually four memorandums filed, and I believe that Dr. Cohen's report was after all four memorandums.
Yes, it was under separate cover.
That's correct. So the way it happened was the time frame of events, the pleas entered on December 6th, then the PSI is ordered. Defendant sits in the PSI and discusses with the PSI writer his reluctance in the plea and that he still wanted to take his case to trial. So that's in the record. It's his statement to the PSI writer, which was filed January 16th. February 20th, the motion is made on his behalf. Other than the statements made to the PSI writer, the appellant did not provide an affidavit. Then the state responds to the motion by appellant. Then there's, I believe there was a hearing where they were able to order the neuropsychological evaluation. Two more memorandums were filed, one by each party. And then there was a hearing on March 21st where appellant's second trial attorney, who had been there with him throughout the course of the proceedings, did orally argue on appellant's behalf and discuss the fact that right after the plea hearing, he had told that attorney that he was very reluctant and that he was very anxious, and that then it started the course of these events. So no, there's no affidavit, but there's additional evidence.
Problem. I don't know if my colleagues as former district judges agree with me, but when you're taking a plea and a person is withdrawing from methamphetamine, is on some other psychoactive drugs, is depressed, is under pressure, and then you say, do you understand what's going on? Of course, they always have to say yes because they're trying to go forward. Then don't you need something more, like I was withdrawing from methamphetamine and I was under pressure and I was taking these psychoactive drugs?
Your Honor, I see my time has run. May I respond?
Please go ahead.
Thank you. So I would agree that you do need something more than just the assertion that I was suffering from withdrawal. In the unpublished case of State v. Jackson from this court on May 11th of 2015, A14-1665 is the appellate reference number. Similar fact basis to what Justice Rodenberg is presenting, a defendant said, I was suffering from withdrawal from my medication, and I felt that I was coerced into that situation. And the court said, yes, we give great deference to the credibility determinations made by a district court, so there weren't any valid reasons to support that. But in this case, we have the reasons advanced by the appellant, and in addition to that, we have the medical support from an expert in the neuropsych eval who sat before appellant and made those determinations. And in addition to that, the district court did not have the opportunity to hear testimony from Dr. Cohen or from the appellant at the time of the plea withdrawal motion. So when the court does not have an evidentiary hearing and have those people before the district court at the time that these claims are being made, you don't have to defer to those credibility determinations. And of course, as you...
My problem with Dr. Cohen's report is that his verb tense is subjunctive, so it's could. I wasn't there, so I don't know. It could have affected him. It's speculative.
Please go ahead.
Justice Braffel, may I respond? Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think that he was making a very sound opinion as a doctor. Of course, he was not present at the time of the plea, so he cannot speculate as to Mr. Davis's state of mind at one point in the past. All he can do is, based on his interviews and based on the medical research, opine as to what he could have been suffering from, which is exactly why it's appropriate under the fair and just standard, because it is a reason advanced that was substantiated. And again, I just want to point out one more thing.
You can wrap up. You've got about 30 seconds to do that.
Thank you. That Justice Rodenberg is absolutely correct, that in these cases, a defendant is always going to say, yes, I do. I waive my rights. Yes, yes, yes. And if you look at the record of this case, very short answers to leading questions, and we wouldn't be here had he not answered those questions. You never are here in a plea withdrawal case. You would hope not to be if those questions were answered appropriately.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The matter is well briefed, well argued. The court will now take this matter under submission and will reach a decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So with that, we have concluded the third matter on our oral calendar. The fourth matter is by ITV, and so we're going to take a recess.